chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with my co-host.
Charlotte Littlefield. Good evening, George.
Oh, Charlotte, how you doing up there? Okay, everything going great?
Yeah, everything's fine. We're having a nice fall. All the leaves have fallen off the trees. It's a real pretty time in the Midwest.
Oh, well, that's great. A lot has happened this week. There have been some appointments and so forth, and we just wanted to get into that. Our second part of this first hour will be with Tara Ross. We're going to replay that because it was important. She's an expert in Electoral College, and we have some issues coming up about the Electoral College that we really need to get into. We need to start with that, I guess. Hillary Clinton's campaign will participate in vote recounts in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. And I believe Jill Stein, has initiated that, the first one already in Wisconsin. She's put the money up. What do you think about that, Charlotte? What's going on here?
Well, I'd like to know what percentage of the votes were counted, on electronic machines that cannot be audited, and I'd like to know what their tabulation, their central tabulation, and what do the mathematicians say?
Yeah, I mean, it looks like, though, that this Jill Stein is coming out from out of left field, and it's going to help Hillary sort of muck things up again, you know? And those are states, those were all Trump states. See, they're not auditing anything else. Jill Stein is only participating in an audit of Trump states. See, that went for Trump. So, and some of those states, I believe one of the states, he only won by 4,000 or 5,000 votes. 11,000 votes in Michigan, I believe. And in some of the other states, there was a more narrow margin than that. So it's going to be very, very interesting as we get further into this, you know.
Absolutely.
Now some of the appointments that Trump has put forward on the table, one is very interesting. He's going to nominate Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education. And she's married to Richard DeVos, heir to the Amway fortune, and she in her own right is a billionaire too, along with her brother. We'll talk about her brother in just a second. So she's all for charter schools. Do you remember who we used to interview way back that was against all of this? And that was Charlotte Iserby. Remember, Charlotte?
Absolutely, absolutely. And John Gatto.
And John Gatto, yes, out of New York, and he was a couple of times, I believe, picked as the Teacher of the Year in New York, I believe, wasn't it?
Yeah, but Charlotte Iserby had a lot to say on the matter.
Yeah, and she goes back to, here's what her letter to the Eagle Forum said one time, and I'll just read a little bit of it. She says that the outcome-based education is communist education based on the 1933 eight-year study drawn up by Progressive Education. She ends her letter with that there are 100 pages within one study that refer to the Soviet polytech system. She says at the end, we are swimming in authentic, original documentation over a period of 80 years, which proves beyond a doubt that the restructuring going on right now is the United Nations lifelong learning plan, which will control Americans pre-birth through death. So she's someone to really respect, isn't she, Charlotte?
Oh, Charlotte Iserby, absolutely, yeah. And I think she single-handedly saved a piece of American history, did she not?
Yes, I think so. Yes.
She salvaged, or not salvaged, but she bought and maintained the congressional records or something. I don't know. She did something important. She captured the history.
Yeah, and if you go to her site, this one site that I'm referring to is chartertruth.com. Now, getting back to Betsy DeVos, she is a proponent, as I understand, of the charter school system, see. And then also she has contacts with a lot of other groups, I think of some of who are behind Common Core in one degree or another. And so, but there's a lot of different education associations and different groups. It's hard to really track her down exactly, okay? But she has been, she is going to be nominated for Secretary of Education. And she in her own right, she's a billionaire. Her husband probably heir to a billion also. But what's really interesting, Charlotte, is her brother is Eric Prince. You remember him?
Yeah, the Blackwater fame.
Yeah. But you know what comes out in addition to that, though, is that, you know, he sold that off and it's called Academy now. And it's gone through several morphings of the names and so forth. But he had very, very scandalous court cases against the Blackwater where they had some unrightful deaths and manslaughter. Some of his people were convicted of manslaughter during all of that Iraq stuff and everything.
Right.
So he finally got rid of that company and sold it off. But now he's working for CITIC, okay? And my gosh, who is CITIC but the Chinese government? It's a Chinese-sponsored corporation called CITIC. It's worth about $600 billion is what its total assets are. And what he's going to be doing about his own interviews recently in Bloomberg that I reviewed, he's going into Africa and he's setting up these airline systems of small planes with Cessnas, and he's going to be flying parts and stuff to Chinese oil operations in China, in Africa. So he's working directly for the Chinese government. He's going to concentrate on Africa, and the Chinese government is in there mining oil and gas and other minerals in Africa at this time. And so by working for CITIC, he's working directly for the Chinese. Now, isn't that something, huh?
Yes, it is. Very something.
And what's really not surprising to us, because we've looked at this for years, is that that Chinese model is somewhere in the background, you know? It's the big elephant that nobody sees, and you know, but finally it's here. But the Chinese model, it looks like, is what they're propelling the Western system towards with state capitalism that David Rubenstein quoted, that he specified that might be the answer to the West's problem of capitalism, is that to move towards state capitalism is the answer, and the Chinese model is state capitalism. So, I mean, we got to wake up to this stuff, huh?
Well, I'd like to see us turn towards protecting our water supplies, you know, and taking care of the environment. You know, we got a lot of people dying of cancer right now, George.
Well, now you make a good point, Charlotte, an excellent point. Maybe Trump, in reorganizing this new government, we can take some of the assets and start allocating some of those towards cleaning up and for our infrastructure and so forth. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
And that would be hiring jobs, providing American jobs, much like during the Depression. There were, national projects and so that some money went into. So that might be something that could be very helpful. What do you think?
Yeah, well, we just can't really have a complete conversation without mentioning the Dakota Access Pipeline either.
Right, right.
It's my understanding there are UN observers there, George.
Well, now, is this true? And I haven't dug down into it. Maybe you've looked at it more. Did the pipeline company strike an agreement with the tribe to pay them a certain amount of money beforehand?
I haven't seen any reports of that.
Now, that's what is being reported here lately. And the other report is that Soros is coming in there, taking the tribe stand to try to demand more money on that agreement. Now, we need to check that out.
We have a water supply, though. We have a watershed. They're putting that very toxic substance in that pipeline. They're putting it at the, they're jeopardizing our water supply source.
I'd say. Well, it's getting a little bit continuous.
You heard about
there,
what happened about that. Yeah, but you heard about the oil spill up in Kalamazoo, right? Michigan? I didn't know anything about it.
What happened?
Over a million gallons of a crude substance, very toxic and damaging to, and, you know, a killer toxic substance,
right.
You know, they over a million gallons spilled out.
Oh, my gosh.
And the company involved was out of Canada. It was called Enbridge. And they instead of going in there and remediating it, it's the largest inland oil spill, and it polluted the drinking water and prompted the a lot of people to move away, and a lot of people got sick and died. And this all happened in the last 5 years right here in Michigan.
My gosh.
And then you got Mississippi is absolutely polluted. The EPA, a lady got put in jail, you know, who was a longtime water person that she was a laboratory technician, and she provided a lot of testings over the last 20 or 30 years. Yeah, and she ends up in prison, and the polluters end up off, and people are still dying, you know, and we still have a polluted environment we must contend with.
Now, this money drives stuff, doesn't it? It's just very, very wicked stuff that
Well, now,
that
what
happens.
Betsy, to get back on point, Betsy DeVos, you know, it's clear that from what I read about her, she was sort of, it's difficult, like you said, to peg down her position on that because it sounds like she was talking out of both sides of her mouth for a long time.
Well, she's very religious, and it's a Dutch that Dutch Reformed religion coming out of the Netherlands. That's her background, okay? And so she has a Christian type of background. And then also she's done a lot, and she's been very active. She's very rich, so she's funded a lot of different education types of initiatives and groups and foundations and things like that. So her giving has been very, very good, see. Now, whether or not she's really keyed in like Charlotte Itherby, don't know about that. These people can be very rich and very, you know what I mean, giving and stuff, but to the wrong causes. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
I mean, they're not street smart sometimes like Charlotte Itherby is. She's been down there in the trenches. See what I mean? Department of Education, seen it firsthand, researched this for years, for decades, if not, you know, 40 or 50, about 30 years here. And so she knows really the really inner workings of this whole plan, see. But she always relates back to this, the Soviets' integration, see, of the education systems, things like that. And I had a friend whose daughter was working on a doctorate degree, and this was after the Berlin Wall came down, and there was this great integration. Her daughter went over to Russia and was studying there and trying and bringing things back for integration. So it's real. I mean, what Charlotte Itherby is saying is real, but many of this very, very liberal community that have been educated in our colleges and universities, they don't really have a clue, you know what I mean, about some of this. You know, that's the way I see it. What do you think, Charlotte?
Yeah, wasn't her book, Charlotte Itherby's book, entitled The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America?
Yes, uh-huh, and that can be found online, I believe. If you put that in a search, you can Google that. And Charlotte Itherby will come up, and she also has a news site, too, off of that. But I think you can still download that PDF file for free. But also, you can go online. If you want to give her some money, go online to Amazon, and I believe you can buy it through Amazon also. She's a really what was important about her, Charlotte, I don't know if you remember this or not, but her dad was a Skull and Bones member.
No, I did remember that, yeah.
He gave her some of his papers when he died, and she turned those over to Anthony Sutton, who wrote one of the definitive books on Skull and Bones. Okay.
Wow.
So I mean, she really goes for the truth. I mean, this lady does. She's well respected, and we haven't interviewed her lately, but we have put her material out there, and we certainly believe. And then there's that John Gatto teacher, right?
Right.
and he's out of New York, and I think he was awarded Teacher of the Year twice, maybe once in New York and once statewide, I think, or whatever. And he says the same things, that this outcome-based stuff is to provide jobs for the corporate structure, but it doesn't really give them an education. See, so it's a conditioning process. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely.
Of job education, but it's, you know, it's just like the social and moral relativism. They don't know when they don't know anything anymore. Have you talked to some of these young people lately, Charlotte? Well, I mean, you're
no,
in contact
honestly,
with them more than
yeah,
I am.
Yeah, well, sure, but we don't talk about things like that. One thing I did watch that was quite interesting, and I want to get back to the CITIC, the Chinese
yeah.
sponsored state corporation that
Okay.
doing business with. Apparently, he's making a lot of waves, that's for sure. He's being investigated for different things. But back to the private financial initiatives that are tied into the public-private partnerships. I guess, George, you what a private financial initiative is something that that comes before a private private-public partnership.
Yes, it does. It but they're hand in glove in a way. In other words, you know the donut of the government communications headquarters? That building, that donut-looking building over there, which is equivalent to the NSA in England, was financed through a private financial initiative. Okay?
What building are you referring to?
I'm talking to the NSA building, the equivalent in England. Okay? It's called the donut. And it's the government communications headquarters building in England. It was financed with private financial initiative money, the building of it. And what that does is it keeps it off of the government books as a debt, okay? But what I'm saying is the people, I started looking at the people that did that, and because they're real insiders, you know. When you're dealing with building the NSA equivalent building in UK, you are an ultimate insider. So it's all people that are being given these great awards of the crown, from the crown and all of that, see. Just a big, big power system. And that's who actually built that building over there, but using private financial initiative techniques. Now, what you're saying about the public-private partnership is more of an ownership thing, even. See what I mean?
Sure.
Where the corporation comes in and uses financial backing or financing from a government, but acquires ownership to that asset. This is a little different. This is where a investment group is providing the financing for building a public structure or building, or, see what I mean, a project. But in doing that, they have the backing of the government to pay them, so it's very secure. See what I mean?
Sure.
But it's not on the books, and that's what they're complaining about in England now, is that there have been several hospitals that have been built over there using this private financial initiative, and they're not able to meet their payments on some of these loans to these private groups. They're not financially able to do it. So, and what happens that I see is that there's usually an inflatable price put up. See what I mean? Because you're dealing with a it's a non-bid basis deal, if you know what I'm saying, okay? And it's not a bond issue by the people that has to be approved. So the price, you know, is going to be very pricey. And when you have things that are very pricey, you're going to have a kickback heaven scheme of kickbacks that's heavenly bound, right? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so,
I sure
not
do.
Heavenly bound, hell bound, but... But anyway, that's what they structure these things. They have to have projects. The elitist, the globalist, the internationalist, whatever you want to call them, they have to have projects to steal money out of. If there's no projects there or cash flow, there's nothing to steal. See, so they always promulgate structures or private, public, private. Partnership deals or private financial initiative deals or something like that. And they're always trying to work deals. See what I mean? And there was one guy that's at the top of the eating chain, and he was trying to take over Japan Post in Japan, which is the 25th largest corporation and asset valued corporation in the world. So I mean, they used to. I'll always say this. They used to mug old ladies on the street. Now they mug countries. You know what I mean? They steal from countries. whole country sometimes, just like Perkins said in his, confessions of a economic hitman. They set up countries to steal from, to promulgate projects that are multi-billion dollar projects, and then they can steal money out of those programs, you know?
Yeah, I'm afraid I can see the picture.
Yeah, anyway, this CITIC, like I said, is worth about $600 billion, and Eric Prince is in there working for him, so he's working for the Chinese government. He's part of the Chinese government. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They not only have, it's called a CITIC group, but it's like CITIC Bank, CITIC Holding, CITIC Trust Company, CITIC Merchant Company. See what I mean? It owns 44 subsidiaries, including China CITIC Bank. Okay. And this, so the CITIC group is really big, see, but it's a financial and investment vehicle for the Chinese government. Now, when you say Chinese government, you have to say the top, military, Shikom officers coupled with their civilians in, the top level families in China. That's what you have to say. So, you know, it's a little, you know, we've got to bring this stuff out. We've just got to talk about it because it's so important. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, nobody else, we talked, the next hour we're going to, play some, interviews that we had of, up in Dallas, but, we talked a little bit. What about this fake news? Are you hearing any more about that, Charlotte?
Well, no. I mean, yes and no. I think it's important that we verify where we get our information and we make sure it's valid.
Yeah.
You know, not to be too quick to just go down too many rabbit holes.
Right.
But
well, the concept, though, has been created by the manipulators. That's a problem, see? In other words, they're trying to lay that label on the alternative news people like us, okay? They're trying to characterize our news coverage and stuff as fake news, see? And so that's the real danger of this right now, is that it's a very dangerous concept that the public hasn't quite been able to, digest, okay, and understand. But the biggest corporations and the biggest media corporations in the world are putting that out. And then they're trying to tag the alternative press and alternative media and characterizing them as fake news generators. See what I mean?
Right.
And so that's basically what's going on there. It's a conniving thing, isn't it? Huh?
Yeah, there's a lot of information out there. We need to keep our eye on the ball.
That's right.
And, I think this Betsy DeVos is someone to watch and to make sure we hold her feet to the fire.
Well, this Munchen guy, this Steve Munchen, that's being considered for Treasury Secretary. Well, he's a Skull and Bones member. He's worked for Goldman Sachs for 17 years. His dad was a general partner of Goldman Sachs for 30 years. And then he goes out here and he's all Hollywood, and enamored with investments there and movies and stuff. And then he had something to do with One West Bank that I know personally, a backroom operation that gave people that were in foreclosure a lot of heartbreak and losses, but with the government backing up the losses to the bank, okay, the foreclosure losses. So they had a guarantee from the government on this. So these people, they don't belong in the U.S. Treasury. That's absolutely. And but what's happening though? It's going to be a mixed bag. What Trump is doing? He's so wealthy that those are the kind of people that he knows. See. So he's going to pull in some good people and some other people, right? Some internationalists, all this, others. So it's not going to be all good people like we want, see what I mean, and desire, but it's going to be a mixture of the two that what I see, okay?
Yeah. What do you think about all this stuff about trying to say that oh, I don't know. Have the protests stopped, you know, around the nation? Have they quit protesting?
I haven't looked at that in the last day. So, what I know personally through friends that have, that are friends with other, you know, not other, but friends with some Democratic, supporters, you know what I mean, is that they're continuing this thing about Trump being a racist and hateful towards the minorities, and he's going to do things. They've had meetings here in our school system in Austin, and it actually gets the students riled up and angry and fearful, and so they're doing fear mongering already, the liberal left. And what they've done is try to rile people up about these changes that are coming, but much of it's an imagined fear that they're fear mongering, okay? But in doing that, then they're building a bigger base for the Democratic left, okay? And that's what I see still going on. And it's, you talk about a great mind wars, deception and delusion, it's ongoing, and it's building up, it's getting worse. And I believe that the violence will follow. I think there has been some violence recently. And so I just don't see a good outcome exactly for that. In your area where you're living in a rural area and a farm type of economy and so forth, you're not going to experience quite the same thing, see, as occurring in the big cities. I mean, there you're not really experiencing anything like this, are you?
No, it's peaceful where I'm at.
I mean, yeah, well, I mean, but now in your larger cities in Missouri, St. Louis, there're probably going to be demonstrations there because, oh, we have a really hardline left communist group on the University of Texas now, okay, coming out of the college.
Really?
Yeah, and we didn't really have that, but it's becoming actively in action against, rallying against and protesting against Trump, see. And so that's the reason that they're using, see, to get out there. See what I mean? And so this is not a good trend. And they're young people, and they're being directed against this capitalism, this evil of capitalism, see?
Okay. Well, how much is the Soros money machine behind all that?
Well, he's worth billions, and so he's been putting millions behind Common Core and all this stuff, you know?
And MoveOn.org.
I think Black Lives Matter, he's funded that recently, 10 or 12 million, stuff like that. See what I mean? And, it's just that the nation is still deeply divided. I ask, and you can hear this later in the second hour from Roger Stone. He seemed to think that the country's slightly to the right, slightly. And then I ask him a question because Bernie Sanders, see, he brought forth the idea that there's a lot of people on the left, socialist left, if not communist left, more socialist than communist left. But they're out for government things. They're out for education, you know, help, free education, free this. But I mean, none of that stuff is free. We've got about a minute, Charlotte. In this first half of this hour, do you have any final statements or any
No, I just want to thank you for having me, George. It was a great conversation.
What we've got to do, and we talk about forgiveness on here and everything, but you know, some of these groups out there that are being wielded against Trump, they're very hate-filled. And then you have these communist groups out there, like in the Austin area now, at the university base, and it's not very, very helpful at all, you know. Anyway, I want to thank everyone out there for listening. In this first hour, we're going to be the last half of it is Tara Ross, and she's going to be explaining more about the Electoral College. But Charlotte, I want to thank you for being with us this evening. We're going to come back for this second hour in just a few minutes after this is over, the first hour. And thank you for listening. Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield. Good evening, George.
Okay, fine. How are you doing, Charlotte, up there in Missouri?
Oh, I'm doing great. I'm having another fall, beautiful fall day. Thanks.
Oh, that's great. We've got really a fine guest with us this evening. And her name is Tara Ross. She's a mother, wife, writer, and retired lawyer. She is the author of Enlightened Democracy, The Case for Electoral College, co-author of another book, Under God, George Washington and the Question of Church and State. And also, she's recently written another book, We Elect a President. She's a constitutionalist, but with a definitive libertarian streak. Welcome to our program, Tara Ross.
Thank you for having me.
Boy, I tell you what, you're a constitutionalist, okay, because you stay on the subject, don't you?
I try real hard. The Constitution is what it all comes down to at the end of the day, and if we stick to that, we'll be doing all right.
Boy, I tell you what, I think this is a timely interview because of the coming election next Tuesday. And so I'm going to really enjoy this interview. And Charlotte's on the other line. Charlotte? This is Tara Ross.
I'm here, George.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And so we're going to get into this Electoral College. How did that originate originally? Was it part of the Constitution or what?
Yeah, it absolutely was. So in the summer of 1787, as our founders were hammering out all the details of what they were going to put in their new Constitution, this recurring theme kept on coming up. That was the conflict between the large and the small states. How do you create a nation composed of both large and small states with different interests, different industries, all sorts of different concerns going on with those voters? And so when it came to the topic of the presidential election system, of course, the small states were really very worried, and they thought the large states are going to outvote us all the time. And they didn't want that. The other idea that was on the table was the idea of Congress selecting the president. So imagine if instead of us going to the polls on Tuesday, Congress just did it,
right.
And that was the way it was done. But there were lots of people that had concerns about that because they felt like the president will be the puppet of the Congress, basically. So why even have one? We're talking about separation of powers and checks and balances and this sort of stuff, and so it doesn't make any sense to have that kind of congressional selection method. So in the end, the Electoral College was created, but it was the result of a compromise that had been made earlier when it came to the composition of Congress. And, of course, as most people, I think, know, the Senate, we have one state, one vote representation. Every state has two senators, no matter what. And in the House, that is based purely on population. So California has way more congressmen than pretty much everybody else. So the Electoral College is a reflection of that same compromise. We have the same number of electors as we have senators plus congressmen.
Right. So it was trying to get around this tyranny of the majority of these large population centers. Is that what actually they set up a mechanism to keep these big populations from dominating? Would that be a good statement?
Sure. I mean, the founders were students of history. They probably knew more than pretty much any of us now, but they knew the history of pure democracies, and they knew that pure democracies tend to implode. And the reason that happens is because in a pure, unfiltered democracy, 51% can tell the other 49% what to do, no matter what. And there's an analogy that I use in a new kids book I have about the Electoral College. Democracy is two wolves and a sheep voting on what's for dinner.
Right. Yeah.
The sheep gets eaten all the time, and that's no fair.
Now, I want to bring up something about Emma. Is she your guinea pig?
Poor Emma.
Is she? In here, you're saying you list her. You're a good lady because you tell who's helped you with the book. I like that. I like that touch. And you say Cooper did some illustrations, but Emma, your daughter, mm-hmm. What did you float stuff by her and just sort of tested things or what?
Well, Emma actually has her own section in the book, and she was responsible for helping me to come up with modern day real life examples of things that would make sense to fourth, fifth, sixth graders. So as an example, in the main text I was talking about why we fought the American Revolution, we had no representation in Parliament. Well, that's kind of a hard concept to wrap your head around if you're 8 or 9 years old. So Emma helped me come up with an example, and her example was my class was voting on what book to read. Charlotte's Web won. That was great, but isn't it also a good thing that the teacher didn't say only blonde kids get to vote?
Oh,
and so
okay.
That was her modern day example. And so there are several of her, they're called Emma's Corner, and they're there's several of them throughout the book, but that was her job, was to always help me figure out what is something that would make sense, you know, to this generation with its TVs and iPhones and all this
right.
stuff like that,
so
you know, and to try to, right.
So you're marketing this.
This is the horse and buggy era principle.
Yeah, right. You started marketing this to that grade school age, right?
Right.
In a way. But also, what I like about this book and everything is that it's something that we need to inform the American public about, you know? And people don't have a
right.
very good grasp sometimes of the Electoral College. How many votes are there? How many electors are there in the college?
There are 538 electors, so it takes a majority of electors to win. That would be 270.
Okay.
If nobody gets a majority, not everybody knows this, but if nobody got the 270, then the next step is the House of Representatives selects a president from the top three vote-getters in the Electoral College.
Oh, okay.
So this has been discussed a little bit this year because there's a third-party candidate who has been doing well in Utah. And if things, I mean, it would still be difficult, but if things fell just right, then what would happen is nobody would get to 270, and there would be a House election among Clinton, Trump, and his name is Evan McMullen. And so in that House election, each state gets one vote. So California gets one vote, Texas one vote,
really?
Wyoming one
really?
Vote. Everybody has one vote.
Okay.
Which people, to us sounds a little crazy, but to the founders, it was just yet another compromise between the large and the small states. And what they thought was, first of all, they thought we would use it more often. But secondly, they thought the large states will have the advantage in selecting a pool of candidates, but then the small states will have an advantage in selecting who's the winner from that pool. So they were, again, trying to balance large and small state interests, and this was just part of their plan.
Right. So out of this 538, three are allocated to what, Washington, D.C.? And then the balance of 535, how is that split between the Senate and the House or what?
Well, so we have those 435 congressmen plus 100 senators plus, you're right, the three D.C.
Okay.
So three electors for D.C.
Oh, okay. Okay. Now, you're saying today, in today's world, they don't actually go to Washington, do they, the electors?
They've never gone to Washington, and that was
okay.
another thing that the founders wanted to do. They thought if you have this body of electors
okay.
that is elected for a one-time purpose,
okay.
they wanted to make them hard to corrupt. Okay, so if they're elected for a one-time purpose
sure.
and you don't have them meet in a central location, they're each in everybody's state, then that would make them harder to corrupt.
Oh, okay. Are they guaranteed that the elector will vote for who they're supposed to vote? How is that mechanism in each of the states exactly?
So every state has a different set of rules. Some states have, I think it's roughly half have rules that say that they're going to bind the electors in some way. The other roughly half, I think it's a little bit less than half, don't have any rule like that at all. So that the electors are either bound by just a promise that they've made to their state, to their state political party,
right.
Or they may not be bound to anybody at all, and it's just, you know, we assume that's what they're going to do because that's what they've always done. Now, historically, this has not been much of a problem, and that's because of the way that these electors are selected. They are party loyalists. I think something else people don't always really realize is that when you go to the polls and you're voting for a candidate, you're not actually voting for that candidate, but you're voting for a slate of electors behind them. Okay, so I'm from Texas. There are 38 Republicans ready to go vote for Trump. There are 38 Democrats ready to go vote for Clinton. And then there are 38 for each of the third party candidates. So we're not asking, you know, if Trump wins Texas, the 38 Republicans will go to Austin and cast the votes, and the same thing for each of the other candidates if they win.
Right.
So we're not asking a Clinton delegate to go vote for Trump or a Trump delegate to go
right.
vote for Clinton.
Okay.
We're asking people to do something that, to vote for their
okay.
His.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was done.
Oh, okay.
So historically, this hasn't been much of a problem. There have been fewer than 20 faithless electors in history.
Oh, okay. So in some of the states, though, it's not clear cut, then, is it, huh? About what their obligations and so forth.
I mean,
yeah. tradition
I mean, so
has this, you know, has happened and sort of, you know, unfolded, right? A tradition, is that right?
Well, it is something that has developed over time. certainly, like, I mean, in the beginning, we didn't, not every state held a popular vote at all. Some states would just appoint their electors directly, and they retained the right to do that at any time. They could just do that again if they wanted to. But over time, we have, you know, this is what people have indicated that they wanted, and this is what state legislatures have done. And so we generally use popular elections to elect our electors. And and historically, this is a system that has been pretty straightforward and has worked pretty well. I think this year you're hearing issues about it more than normal.
Right.
It's the reflection, I think, of the year.
Yeah, Charlotte and I, 10 years ago, our first program was about election and voter fraud. Can you believe that? Yeah, I mean, almost to the day, November 1st, 2006, we started this program, The Secret Truth, and our first program was on voter and election fraud. And now it looks like that there's a lot of things going on. What do you think about these electronic machines? What's your idea about that?
Oh, gosh. I probably will leave it to people who study that. What I will say, though, is that the Electoral College is actually a great safeguard, believe it or not, against voter fraud. And the reason is because in order to steal an election, you need several things going your way.
Okay.
First, you need the national election to be close. Okay, so if it's like five or six states determining the thing, you know, that's not a close election, right? You'd have to swing five or six states to steal five or six states.
Okay.
The other thing is the states that you would need states with the right number of electoral votes to also be close. Okay. So, right. I mean, and so then the other thing is you would need to be able to predict in advance that which state you need to steal. And so right now we have a situation where the other part of it is that it's probably easy to steal votes for the Democrats in a place like California, which is going Democrat anyway. So who cares how many votes they steal there? You could say the same thing about Texas Republicans, probably. You know, if a state is that safe, where it is that easy to steal votes, then probably it didn't really matter. And where it is hard to steal votes, where you want to steal votes, it is harder because there are more people watching. That's probably more of a swing state with more of a mixed bag of whether Republicans or Democrats are in charge of the state. So it's just, I'm not saying it's impossible because nothing's ever impossible. There will always be dishonest people, but it does make it as hard as possible because instead of having to defend every single precinct in the entire country from stolen votes, you're just down to your top, I don't know how many, but your top handful of precincts that you're going to defend.
Well, Charlotte, what's your opinion about these? Charlotte and I sort of reached the conclusion that we need to go back to paper ballots, though, because then there's a hard proof of what is that about what you think, Charlotte, or what?
Yeah, well, I'm concerned about the central tabulation of this stuff and that fractional math.
So that's your problem with it, huh, Charlotte?
Yeah, I think that.
Go ahead.
Well, I've traveled too much to speak intelligently to that one. I've moved. I've lived in so many different states. I don't know what the majority is in the state I'm living in, I'm afraid.
Right. So, Tara, we've reached the conclusion that this paper ballot thing is you can go back in and open that box up and start counting it. You know, this electronic thing is really tough. Now, one of your questions here, if Hillary's elected, she couldn't be impeached, could she, or what?
Well, she could probably be impeached like now. There are legal scholars that would argue that she could be impeached today.
Really?
Because of her time as Secretary of State.
The
issue is because the Constitution, now there's one part of the Constitution where it says, you know, president, vice president, other civil officers, but there's other places where it speaks of a person, like not an officer, but a person. And the other aspect of this is that they say, there's two parts to the punishment, right? One part is removal from office, and people focus on that. But the other part is disqualified from future office. So the argument that is made by some legal scholars is that because of her time as Secretary of State, she could be impeached now for any offenses committed during the time of Secretary of State. And that would be because the founders wanted to give Congress recourse to stop someone who might abuse government power.
Right. What if Obama comes around here at the end of his term and pardons Hillary? Could that get her off of everything?
Well, it would get her off of any criminal ramification for anything that she might have done, but a president cannot pardon her in such a way that she would get off of any impeachment. Impeachment is a separate remedy that is for Congress to decide.
Well, how about amnesties that come into play under the pardon, U.S. pardon law? Is there something that can pardon you from future stuff or not? Through an amnesty type of blanket coverage or what?
Do you mean like a blanket amnesty for?
Well,
like,
I think the U.S. Pardon law does have elements of amnesty built into it. They seem to think that they can pardon you from something, some future act. Is that possible or not?
Oh, well, okay. So with the caveat that this is you're leaving my area.
Oh, okay.
I don't think you can be pardoned for future stuff. I think you can only be pardoned for past stuff.
I went in and did a little research, and it has an amnesty element to it, and I didn't drill down a whole lot into that. But that could be an interesting thing to flesh out. I'll look into that more because, you know, into the future. But the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, really protects the individual. So there are these balances built into the Constitution also, are there not?
Yes, of course. And, I mean, that was the structure of the whole thing. The founders thought, you know, we can't trust government officials with too much power because they're human beings who are corruptible, who are imperfect, who are power hungry sometimes. There were also other checks and balances on the people, honestly, and that's basically to protect from that analogy I described of two wolves eating the sheep. So
right.
The founders just kind of thought, look, all around, people are imperfect, and this has ramifications. And you know, even when people don't mean to stumble, they do. And so they just wanted lots of checks and balances throughout their government in lots of different ways, and they just felt like power – you know, struggling against power, basically, is the best way to check these kinds of tendencies.
Right. It seems like, though, with the power of the media today over what it was in 1800, things have changed a great deal, see? And so the public is being able to be manipulated, it seems like, more in a scientific way, almost. Because the consolidation of all these media companies, the conglomerates, been a real problem to maintaining our freedoms and liberties, or what?
Well, I mean, I think Thomas Jefferson had a lot to say about if the media is not honest, then that's pretty terrible.
It is. But, and it's getting that way, it seems, yeah. You know?
But I also think at some point, you know, anything that goes wrong, we the people have only ourselves to blame at its heart. I mean, I do think that the more uneducated we are, the more uninformed we are about our political system in general, the easier it is for us to be swayed by whatever story the media chooses to run that day, you know. And so I hope this election, you know, obviously has been a little bit crazy. I hope that one silver lining is that people will take time to learn more about their political system and why things have been set up the way they are. It's made me really sad this year. There have been several points at which I thought things were being misunderstood, like checks and balances and safeguards in our system were being misunderstood, like they were a problem because they went against democracy or something. But that misunderstands our system, which, again, is just a series of checks and balances. We are self-governing, absolutely. I mean, the founders fought a revolution because they wanted to be self-governing. We are self-governing.
Right. Sure.
But we have checks and balances, too, and that doesn't make the system somehow rigged or any way terrible. It just means we have checks and balances.
Right. This Trump candidacy, though, has it activated people that were not active politically before? Has his campaign just activated a number of people that were sort of inactive or apathetic about politics? Would you say that? What's your view there?
I don't know. I guess we'll see what happens on Tuesday, and we'll decide. We'll see what happened then. I kind of don't know how to analyze that, just to tell you the truth.
Yeah, right. And, of course, all of these email things are continuing to come out all the time, you know. There's a record also turnout in early voting. I guess you have that in the Dallas area, too, occurring. But you have a lot of cities up there.
Yeah, but who knows why they're doing it, right?
Huh?
So, I mean, are they? Who knows why they're turning out in record numbers, right? I mean, are they turning out because they hate the other candidate so badly? Are they hating, are they turning out because they love their candidate and they, you know, or are they turning out because they didn't like either one of them and they wanted to go vote for somebody else? I mean, I feel like, you know, I was looking at the story about, and I don't know the answer, but I was looking at the story about 1948. Do you remember the headline, Dewey defeats Truman?
Right.
The pollsters were all wrong. And so I kind of wonder if in a year like this, when things are so skewy, if the pollsters, and not, I'm not blaming them. I'm not saying, but I just wonder, I wonder what we'll find out on Tuesday. But I think it could be any of these things, by the way. I don't think we know which candidate, Trump, Clinton, or third party is being skewed against in these polls. I'm curious to see.
Right. Some of these polls are weighted in there. They've already, if you read down into the poll and it, the way they describe the poll sometimes, some of the polls have been weighted towards the Democratic Party in some cases. And so, yeah, the polls are hard to rely on sometimes in this particular election year. I've gone back, I'm 72 right now, so I've seen a few of these elections, but this one is just hard to call. Even some of the experts, I think, out there are having a hard time reaching a conclusion. And especially some of this cheating and election fraud and so forth is going on out there already. There are dead people. They're tombstoning some of these states already, you know.
Yeah, I mean, some of those stories, I think the alleged fraud made headlines, and then the, oh, we made a mistake, didn't make headlines. Like, there were a couple of those things in Texas that I knew about where somebody said their vote got changed, and then, oh, wait a minute, maybe I just messed up. I'm sorry. I don't really know.
Yeah, there's that old classic primary that LBJ stole from Coke Stevenson in 1948 in Texas.
Yeah.
That Robert Caro wrote about in those biographies of LBJ. That's sort of interesting, you know. And that occurred in 1948, you know. So that was paper ballots then, see. So even in those, if you have dishonest people, it doesn't matter the system, they'll try to cheat it, right?
That's pretty much what I think. I would never claim that there are zero problems. Clearly there are dishonest people. There are people trying to cheat. This is part of human nature. So I take comfort from the fact that the Electoral College makes it as hard as possible. So again, there's no such thing as impossible, but you can make it as hard as possible. You can give them as many hurdles to climb as humanly possible.
Right. Could you mention something about your other books that you've written and co-authored with, and sort of tell us a little bit about that? Under God, George Washington and the Question of Church and State. What was that about? Because we'll have your page up right now, Tara, and so they'll have access to any of the books and information, newsletter, if they want to get on there, and how to contact you and all that other stuff. But what about some of these other books, that you've written also along with, this last one, We Elect a President? What about some of those books? The Case, you know what I mean, Under God. Yeah, that one. What about that book?
Under God is a book that I wrote with a lawyer named Joseph Smith from Colorado.
Okay.
And basically, we just wanted to spend time studying what George Washington had to say about matters of church and state. There is such a disproportionate amount of attention paid to Thomas Jefferson and really just one letter that he wrote, which is where that phrase separation of church and state came from.
Okay.
And George Washington, on the other hand, so Thomas Jefferson was overseas. He wasn't at the Constitutional Convention. He wasn't there when the Bill of Rights was written. I mean, he was serving his country overseas, but he wasn't here for those critical events. George Washington was.
Okay.
Not only that, but George Washington dealt with a lot of issues that you don't really even think about until you stop and focus on it. He dealt with Quakers who didn't want to fight because it went against their religious convictions, you know, chaplains in the army. There was points at which missionaries were going to be sent out into the frontier and to try to help out there. I mean, there were lots of different things that came up while he was general and while he was president and even during his time in state service. And so we just trace his life from beginning to end and what his views were, what the issues were he had to deal with in each of these phases of his life. And basically came to the conclusion that, you know, George Washington was just kind of a practical, pragmatic kind of guy. And he saw that if you want to have a successful self-governing nation, then you need to have a moral and virtuous people. And if you want a moral and virtuous people, well, you've got to have religion. So, you know, but he, when he did it himself, he tended to do it in this kind of non-denominational way. He tried to be inclusive. I think he probably knew better than anybody from his time in the Army what a great diversity of people were in this new country. And so, you know, he was more monotheistic than not, more Judeo-Christian than not, but you can find exceptions even to that. Like when he was speaking with Indian tribes and such, sometimes he would use the phrase, you know, Great Spirit or something like that. So he, I think he was just looking really hard to find a good balance where, church and, you know, the state and church could work together in partnership, without endorsing a particular denomination. And I think he struck a pretty good balance most of the time.
Right. You know, he pardoned the leaders of the Whiskey Rebellion. He gave them pardons. I didn't know that until I started studying the pardon thing recently. he did suppress the Whiskey Rebellion pretty harshly. But he did later pardon the leaders or the conspirators or whatever you want to call them of the Whiskey Rebellion. So I see that your writings have centered around the Constitution, Electoral College, mm-hmm. and so forth. And I find that very interesting. We've got about 2.5-3 minutes left. What would be some of your closing comments, Tara?
The other thing that I do sometimes, I have a Facebook page where I post a historical moment every morning. And that can be, it's often American Revolution related, but it's other things too sometimes. And I think what I most would want people to know is just what a great nation we have. And there are so many great patriots that went before us, and not to believe some of this, it just that there's so much sometimes to people trying to make us feel like ashamed of our heritage or something that, you know, everybody's got some bad stuff that they wish they could change. But overall, America has been a force for good and for bravery and for perseverance and for, you know, it's just freedom and liberty. And I would just encourage people to spend more time on your own, you know, finding resources, reading biographies, doing whatever, but just learning more about this, not through a media filter, because we have so much to be proud of.
Right. Charlotte, do you have a contribution or a question? Charlotte?
Oh, no, I'm enjoying the conversation. Thank you.
Well, you know, this has been a very nice interview, and I really like your view, Tara. You've got a balanced, very pragmatic view, and you really describe the Electoral College real well. And I think many of our listeners understand it a little bit better than they did before. I mean, there's this population, there's a certain group out there that wants it all total popular vote, right? You know, the majority of the tyranny of the majority gang, you know, could say.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe you make a very strong case for something that is more balanced and I think better for our democratic republic than without it, you know. So the Electoral College is a positive vote in my book, you know. And also, you've written some very lovely books and so forth, and we certainly respect your work and your dedication to the Constitution and to the United States.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Well, Tara, thank you for being with us this evening. And
we have
up all of these. Charlotte, any comments, Charlotte?
No, I just want to thank Tara as well. Thank you very much.
Okay, Tara.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you very much for being with us. And we have up all these click-offs right now on our homepage, thesecrettruth.com. But thank you so very much for being with us this evening. And good evening. Good night.
Thank you.